Hi, everyone, and welcome to The Contrarians with Adam and Adir, the only pod that takes you behind the scenes and gives you the inside word on the world of tech and growth from the insiders. I'm Adam Schwab, co-founder of Luxury Escapes, journalist and angel investor, and I'm joined by my great mate, Adir Schiffman, executive chairman of Catapult Sports and serial investor. This week, we talk about Apple's new iPhone release, the controversy surrounding Hamburg University, and the rise and possible fall of the gig economy. Support for The Contrarians comes from Bench Media. One of the most important things a business can do is choose the right digital marketing agency. Get it wrong, and it literally costs you millions. Adi, you used to run a digital agency, so you probably know a lot more about this than I do.
I agree with you on digital agencies. I mean, there are so many agencies that they're not strategic, they're hands-off, they just outsource the work to the cheapest people that they can find. And as a client, it's pretty hard to know what's going on. You don't know what you're getting. And it's just a massive leap of faith being able to trust your agency.
And that's where Bench Media is so good. Bench was founded by engineers and marketers. They opened access to the digital advertising ecosystem, allowing brands and agencies to access over 100 data and media partners easily. Bench has even created their own bespoke technology, giving their clients full control and delivering better ROI. They work on their clients to craft campaigns that cover every facet of digital marketing, including at-home, BVOD, and programmatic radio. You're a big out-of-home fan as well, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. So you mean like billboards, etc. I always joked they call it out-of-home because they think that billboards doesn't sound sophisticated enough, so they have to change the name to out-of-home so people say, what's out-of-home?
Yeah, and Bench has tools such as path conversion and brand lift studies, the type of stuff that usually only happens at the big enterprise level, which they make so much more accessible. It's no surprise that Bench works with some of the most impressive businesses in Australia, with a star-studded client list, including global food giant Nestle, Samsonite, and Epson. So if you have an ad budget of more than $1 million annually, give Bench Media a call on 1300 049 498 or go to benchmedia.com to see what they can do to take your media marketing mix to the next level.
Now, back to the pod.
So, Adir, has been a big week for you?
Yeah, I had a funny experience this week I wanted to run by you, and you can tell me what you think about it. So one of the challenges I've got with my car is that basically it's a magnet for flat tires, and so I'm constantly changing my tires. Actually, I think I've changed six tires in the last year and a half. I've only got four wheels, so it's actually been insane.
Are you changing the tire with your bare hands, or are you calling RACV
and coming out and changing it? Three that broke, I would pull over at the side of the road and do it myself and put on like a, one of those like space saver tires.
That's very impressive.
Right? Like
that's impressive stuff.
It's unbelievably impressive. You know, it takes a very special couple of guys to think that changing a tire is impressive. So I'm happy that I'm speaking to the right person about my changing the tire. Once I got to number four, within a year, I was like, I'm just going to go home and call the company that comes to you and swaps your tire so I don't have to take it to anywhere to get done. And so, unsurprisingly, 200 meters from my house, I had another flat tire last week. But this is the interesting experience. So they came to...
Is someone slashing your tires, you think? Is someone one of the disgruntled podcast victims?
Well, given my personality, that was my first thought, obviously. But it turns out, this didn't even have a puncture in it. It was just the tire is like this very wide, very soft tire, and it just it was only like a year and a half old. So anyway, so there was another $650, $700 down the drain with that.
Per tire? That's extraordinary. $600 per tire. Keelan, what do you pay for a tire?
I pay about $100 from a secondhand dealer.
That sounds
A secondhand tire. What's that? The first guy thought their life was too important to keep running on a bald tire, and you're like, for $100, I'll take the risk.
Well, given how long your tires will last, I reckon $100 tire is probably doing.
I've started just walking everywhere because I can't afford the cost of changing the tires.
I'll tell you, I bought an electric bike about a month ago off Facebook Marketplace. So I paid $1,600 for it, or maybe $1,650. I can't remember exactly how much it was. I can get to 40 k's an hour in like 5 seconds, barely trying. It goes at the same speed as traffic. You never sweat because it's got the electric help. It's incredible. And I get from our office in South Melbourne to 101 Collins Street in like 9 minutes.
That's pretty great. Unbelievable. That's pretty great. I want to tell you the tire story, but I'll tell you this. A friend of mine who's an ophthalmologist. I won't say his name, but I studied with him in medical school. He topped the year. And he's a fantastic guy, and he works in the city now at the Eye and Ear Hospital. So like a big shot. And he lives in Brighton in Melbourne. He's very fit. Like you would get on well with this guy, okay? And like I said to him, how do you get into work? Do you ride into work? And he goes, nah, I don't ride into work. And I thought that I'm surprised by that. And then he says to me, I run into work. Every day he runs. What's that? 15 Ks? It's got to be each way.
At least each way.
I'm like, I don't even want to. What I was going to meet him there, and I didn't even want to drive that far. And he's running there every day and back. Anyway, so let me tell you this tire story. Tell me what you. It does have some business relevance. Okay, so a lovely guy came and he swapped my tire, and I was just chatting with him, and I said to him, "How's business?" Because, like, I'm sure you do this as well. You just ask everybody that you meet, like, you're trying to get a feel for what the economy's like. And this is what he said to me. He said to me, actually, it's really slow because he could come same day. I got it like 10 a.m., the puncture, and it was done 3 p.m., swapped. And it's unusual. Yeah. Like, there's no one with more experience in the time frame for tire swapping than me. And that's very fast. Okay. And so I said, what's the story? And he said, it's been really quiet. You know, this economy is making people not change their tires unless they've got no choice. Nobody is asking to change their tire when there's like any quality left on the tire. Now people are holding off. And interestingly, I had a hairdresser the other day say to me, people that were getting their hair colored, I mean, it's probably, sorry about women, but we're getting their hair colored every 2 or 3 weeks, every couple of weeks, are pushing it out a week or two now, and it's much less busy because people are waiting longer to get their hair recolored or whatever else they do. And so, like, is that what you're feeling as well when you talk to people, that definitely there is an economic slowdown that's going through the economy, or is that just the people I'm speaking to?
Yeah, so last week I was at Gimlet with a very successful business person, probably more successful than myself, and I was surprised how busy it was, and the pricing of that place. It's obviously a very good place. I think it could be a top 50, certainly top 50 in Australia now. I'm top 10 in Australia, but it was, you pay, like, we didn't drink, as you know, I don't drink. We didn't have dessert, didn't have sides, and it was still $100 a head, which is a lot more than I would usually like to pay. And it was full. It was completely full. And I had to make a booking, and I couldn't get a booking the week before. So people were willing to pay, and so let's bear in mind, I probably paid less than most. Most people probably not walking out there for less than $200 a head. And that place was full. So there is people spending still a lot of money on stuff that you don't really need to spend $200 for lunch. You can probably spend 20. There's definitely some economic dualism here.
I mean, restaurants is a special. I mean, firstly, I just want to say I'm disappointed that you couldn't pass the cost of your lunch to the person you were having lunch with. That's my
we went half.
That's my strategy, but it backfires on me mostly, and I find myself paying for lunch with other people. But you know Chris Lucas, who I don't know if you know Chris.
Your old mate.
Yes, okay, my mate. So he said to me that the upmarket, you know, his restaurants are all. He's very good at like getting ultra cool restaurants, and they're expensive, right? And he said it's crazy, like it's so busy. And so I agree with you, like people talk about this two-speed economy and it's all this economics kind of jargon, but when you go into the economy and you've got hairdressers and people changing tires and they're saying people, no one is spending money, and then you've got, you know, $200 a head. And by the way, I suspect there are people that spend substantially more than $200 a head at that restaurant. Like when they're booming, like that is the real two-speed economy. And that's what you were saying last week about inflation impacting poorer people much more than it impacts wealthy people.
I think some people are willing to pay for Chris Lucas's restaurants, for Andrew McConnell's restaurants, because they feel they're getting very good value. The quality is excellent. I think where we're seeing the drop-off is you can probably put back a tire for an extra 6 months. You probably won't skid off the road and die. You'll probably be fine.
So, I mean, let's just say that is not, you're not providing motoring advice on this program. So nobody should follow that advice.
Do not put off your tire.
I can't put off a tire for 6 months. I have to change 4 tires every 6 months.
Next time I listen to, I'm definitely 100% calling you because I'm not a tire changer. Why don't we get into our first proper story this week, which is about Apple, which is the world's most valuable company. Apple last week held its annual iPhone launch, releasing the iPhone 15, which seems fairly similar to the previous model, but with the usual slightly better camera, and a lot of the media focused on the switch from a Lightning adapter to a USB-C after threats from European regulators. Apple shares are trading 11% off their August record level, but the company is still worth US $2.75 trillion, slightly ahead of Microsoft, which is trading at US $2.5 trillion. Interestingly, Alphabet / Google is way back in fourth spot at a relatively miserly $1.7 billion. Apple's recent share price weakness wasn't because consumers hated the new iPhone, but on concerns that China is preventing its public sector employees from potentially owning iPhones, and concern that that could lead to a wider ban of Apple products in China. China is Apple's largest international market, accounting for around 20% of Apple's annual revenues. So, Adir, are you an Apple bull or an Apple bear at this stage?
So here are my three comments about this Apple story, as you were, I was thinking of them as you were saying it, so hopefully they're coherent. One, a new camera is not innovation. That's my first comment. Two, I think they've got very big problems in China. And three, I'm completely opposed to the compulsory USB-C ruling that came out of Europe. That's the one I'm most interested in talking about, that third one.
Why don't we go C to A? I actually like the USB-C.
I knew that you would like it. I knew it.
I'm being contrarian. I think they changed. My kids, iPads are USB-C now. It's a bloody hassle having half USB-C and half Lightning. I just want everything the same. And that, I think if everything goes to USB-C, be it Apple, Android, whatever, like the moment you've got three systems, you've got Lightning, USB-C, and the Android one, which is the same as the Kindle one, I just want them to all be the same. I don't have to hunt around for a cable every time I want to plug something in, which is never what happens.
Yeah, so I understand that argument. And I think that is a good argument. The problem with that argument is, where is the innovation going to come from? So the reason that we have USB-C, so forget about Apple and their Lightning, okay? Like, they like proprietary stuff, like, just put that to the side. Nintendo also loves proprietary stuff, right? By the way, like when they created, I mean, years ago when they did their GameCube and they finally bit the bullet and did CDs, they didn't want to do CDs because, you know, you copy the CDs. But the cartridges, when they did a CD, they made it a different size to everybody else's. It was like crazy stuff, right? So like, I agree with that. But the only reason there's a USB-C is because, you know, at the same time they were developing USB-C, they were developing USB 3.0, which is just like a faster version. And, you know, USB-A is what everyone knows as USB, like the big fat one. And then there's USB-B, which is the square one, which is rare now. And then mini USB and micro USB. And the reason that all – and, like, I know it's boring for me to say those things, but the reason that that all happened is because there was an advantage in continually improving the connector, and – that is what innovation is. I will say this. Don't you think, like, micro USB is an amazing connector because you put it in and you put it in the wrong way, and then you turn it upside down and it's the wrong way, and then this alternate universe rolls through and you turn it the first way, and then suddenly that was the right way to begin with. Like, it never works. that connector never works until you've tried it twice, right?
It's like a toast always falls by the side down. I mean, it's a gravitational.
Yeah, well, this has got some – they haven't worked out the physics of that micro USB yet, I don't think. But and so there would be no USB-C if there hadn't been a reason to innovate. And my problem with this is not the standardization. It is, where is the next connector going to come from? That is, where's the innovation going to come from for the next connector? That's my issue with this.
That's right. But is the next connector potentially not a connector? Like, I charge my phone now on a pad. Eventually, I don't think we're that far away from charging on random surfaces. So maybe we don't, you're right. I agree with you on that point. But maybe we just don't need another one. Is there that much more innovation to be had?
It's possible. But, you know, that's a tangential argument, which is, government regulating something that didn't need to be regulated might not turn out that badly. Like, that's kind of that argument. And my issue is,
it's very rare. I don't ever agree with the European, those idiots are the ones who did, you know, every time you got to click on the accept cookie button now, every time you got a new website, whoever thought of that should be, like, literally hanged. Like, that was the dumbest thing
ever.
You know
who should be on the gallows next to them? The people that let credit card merchants pass on the credit card fees to customers. Because before that happened, basically the merchant just absorbed the fee, and all that happened is everything went up by the credit card fee. The credit card provider doesn't care, and the merchant just gets to pass the cost on to the customer. I was happier when the merchant was absorbing the cost.
Well, as a merchant, we actually absorb the cost, but at some point we won't.
I'm surprised that you do. Why do you?
Just because you haven't got around to passing it on. The original reason and the main reason is we only had a credit card option, and both morally and potentially legally, but certainly morally, we've never felt comfortable charging a credit card fee if we didn't have a free option. So I think you've got to have an option, which is a bank-to-bank option. We've never had that. We never had Poly. Poly's now about to be turned off. It hasn't been turned off already. I think it's turned off in a few weeks. So we're looking at, there's a whole new open banking regime. So I know a lot of people listening to the show have businesses. Certainly worth looking into. We're going with Go Cardless. There's As You Pay. There's a few great Australian businesses doing some great innovation there to allow bank-to-bank transfers happening quite quickly, pretty much costlessly. So it actually will be quite revolutionary.
Well, I agree. Like, so Daily Blooms doesn't charge a credit card fee, but if you book you're in the travel space. I think every airline charges a credit card fee. There's not one that doesn't charge a credit card fee that I've ever come across. So I thought it would be more common in your space. Do hotels.com charge a credit card fee or not?
I'm not sure about booking in hotels, actually. I have to double check. I don't think they do.
But the story is that people should race as quickly as possible to book on luxury escapes right now before you introduce your credit card fee.
Well, ultimately, we'll have a free option, which is bank-to-bank. So we certainly won't be introducing any fees without A, testing it first, and B, ensuring there's a free option, because certainly customers need to have a free option. So moving on to the first point you made, which I think was a really good point, and I'd love to get your view on this. So you've got the Steve Jobs versus Tim Cook, and obviously they're great friends and they're not competing against each other, but Steve Jobs, that great innovator, by all accounts, loathsome guy, but a genius, versus Tim Cook, who's meant to be a lovely guy, but hasn't really innovated at all. If you look at all about Apple's innovation since Steve Jobs died, I guess you got AirPods, which is a great business, but minimally innovative and really based on the iPhone. iPad was Jobs. App Store was Jobs.
How about the watch?
30% toll was Jobs.
I think the watch was Tim Cook. I think the watch is innovative. That's innovative. Tim Cook gets...
You can argue the watch is a second screen for an iPhone in many ways.
You can argue that the iPhone was just a better version of an iMate using its own operating system. You remember the iMate? Did you ever see that thing? It was like a Windows CE device or whatever the early thing was. It had a keyboard. It was connected. It was.
Oh, so Jobs never invented anything. He just got existing products and made them 100 times better. Yeah. Like iPod was a. There were MP3 players around well before the iPod came around. He's made them better. But the iPhone was so revolutionary in terms of the interface, the full glass screen. They definitely took it. Johnny Ive's design was incredible. I mean, Steve Jobs was there all the way. Are you a Steve Jobs guy or are you a Tim Cook guy, or are you both?
I think Tim Cook, this is what I've got a few thoughts about this whole area. I think Tim Cook gets a raw deal from people that say, like, he's a non-innovator. He took a company, he increased the size of it 10 times, he continued to have a pipeline of products coming through. Like, he didn't invent the next iPhone, but, you know, like, nothing has really been the next iPhone. I think, wasn't one of the lines of Mac's his, the MacBook or some, one of the lines of Mac's was his, I thought. I might be wrong, but...
No, I think he was a logistics supply
chain guy. No, but I think you can't criticize this guy for what he's done to that company. And I think there's been a pipeline of good enough innovation coming through. And certainly, you know, this whole idea of these Apple conferences where Steve Jobs gets up and does all this exciting stuff and there's music and whatever. Like, it's a crazy concept, right? It's like he's some kind of entertainer. When actually what he's doing is saying, I really need you to buy this stuff so I can make more money. I mean, that is really what's going on there. And I think, and like what he stands up and says, I'm amazing. My company's amazing. This product is amazing. Your life will be amazing if you give me money. And I think Tim Cook has replicated that impeccably well. He's getting up there and people are clapping about a better camera. People are clapping that you can send a business card electronically by putting your phone next to somebody else's phone. I mean, who's clapping? Why are they clapping? What are they clapping about? But he's got them clapping and paying. They keep paying. And so definitely I think they're different, but I think Apple in general. So I'm going to now offend everyone who is listening in the Netherlands. So the Netherlands...
I reckon we got a lot of listeners in the Netherlands.
Tons. Well, they're all on bikes riding next to canals. And so basically, by the way, I do love Amsterdam. It's a fantastic city. But when you go there, it's like, it feels very rich, that city. And it's got these, you know, I'm going to say it's called the Rijksmuseum, where like all the, you know, the masters are and whatever else. But the truth is, like a lot of these European cities are still enjoying the fruits of like 300 years ago, you know, their great colonial past. I don't say that as a political comment. Like, you know, they were a great colonial empire and they made a lot of money. And now they got some good things. Like, they've got Royal Dutch Shell. That's a good company. And a few others. I'm not being disparaging of them. But they are this beautiful, incredible country. And a lot of that is because they created this very rich empire historically. So that's Apple, in my view. Now, that's like, I know some people will disagree with that, but I think today I use Apple. I use a phone. I don't use I'm against MacBooks because I'm old school and I still, you know.
I hate MacBooks.
Also, Excel doesn't work on a MacBook, you know. Like, Excel is junk. Yeah. I'm basically trapped in there because there is really no compelling reason for me to shift. And Apple is the beneficiary of a lot of that history, is my view.
I think if you look at Tim Cook's been an incredible operator. So I agree in many ways. He hasn't, if you look at people who follow, it's very hard to follow a founder. Remember Howard Schultz of Starbucks, about 8 people tried to follow him and everyone stuffed it up.
I think that he didn't mind really that, hard. Right? He was happy because that's, some founders like that. You know, look, no one is as good as me, just fire them. I'll come back. I'll save you.
Obviously, Steve Jobs didn't have that opportunity. But I think, look at Tim Cook. He's been a brilliant second, second founder or whatever you want to call it. That said, you look at, and he's taken Apple's share price, market cap from 300 million. I think it was about 300 billion when Steve passed away, give or take. And now it's 2.75 trillion. So that's almost
10x. Yeah, I just call it 10x. He 10x that company, which.
Yeah, which is unbelievable. Yeah. But if you look at it another way, it's trading on a PE of 30. It's super rich. Yeah. And part of the PE is because of the App Store, because the recurring revenue. That was Jobs, by the way. And if you look at the risks around Apple, clearly China is a massive one. And that's really problematic. I'm surprised China haven't banned it, given the Huawei banning reciprocally. So China's a massive, that's 20% of their sales. And also, obviously, a lot of that production still, because they haven't moved it to India and Vietnam fully yet. But the other big risk is the 30% toll that Apple takes on App Store is a big risk. You can argue it's justified or not. I think it's hard to argue 30% is. Apparently, Steve Jobs just made up a 30% number. He goes, oh, let's just choose. Remember, it's like a credit card fee, which is usually, we talk about, it's usually called 1.5%. This is
30%. But don't we all just make up numbers? You think about your businesses. How many numbers that exist today are like, I didn't know, I just made up a number? Like, that's what we all do.
Absolutely. But this is a made up number that's 25x. The competitor credit card number. So it's an unbelievably good made up number. But more about this. So this Apple trades on 30 PE, which is pretty lofty for a mature business that's not without risk. So you could argue Apple could have a 12, which is what it had 2 years ago. Goes back to 12 PE, suddenly it's worth 1.3 trillion, which is still incredible. But suddenly Tim Cook 6x'd it, and it's probably about what the market's done. So you can, we look at Tim Cook's legacy now, and it's incredible, probably by far the greatest wealth creation of any CEO in history. We could be looking in a year's time, which we'll come back in a year's time on the show, and it could be underperforming the market, possibly. So I'm not sure that legacy's owing.
But when you look at the flip side, if you had to bet at the time that he took over, because he wasn't really a known quantity outside, you know, people in the markets in the US, analysts sort of, there was a fairly high chance he'd destroy the business, right? Like, people thought, this is all going to, it's all about Steve Jobs. And so to me, the reassuring thing about it is, it just goes to show yet again, the lack of indispensability of anybody in an organization. And that, you know, even a great founder, ultimately you can find people that, to run it, and it can survive without them. And that kind of is reassuring to me because, you know, like nobody is indispensable. And so I kind of quite like that as a concept.
I think the other point with Tim Cook and why it was such a great transition is he started Apple in 1998 as a SVP of Worldwide Ops and effectively was Steve Jobs' right-hand man for at least 5 or 6 years, I think. So, and I think he may have stepped in when Steve was sick and stepped out potentially as well. So he'd had that time as well. So he'd had 13 years of the business, which is significant. So I think if you look at the great founder to IC transitions, and obviously Warren Buffett at Berkshire is going through this now, they do seem to have been in the business for at least a few years. It's ones that sort of come in cold, rushed in, like what happened with John Sculley and Steve Jobs at first, although Steve wasn't CEO, I should say, but that's when it tends to go right. The 13-year tenure, I think, really helped.
I agree. And look, there are some exceptions to this that both of us would feel, and I'll say the exception, but my view is an internal promotion in an organization is vastly better. It's a much bigger win for a company than hiring something for someone from the outside. That's true at the CEO level. It's true at most levels in my personal view. The exception is when you've got a business like, you know, luxury escapes or something else, like let's say you tried to bring someone in, like there are businesses that grow very rapidly and you can't have somebody in that is like experienced enough to take over a CEO from the founder. And so it's hard because it's hard to keep them in as not being the person in charge. And so I think that's why, you know, a lot of rapidly growing businesses tend to bring people in from the outside. But for a business like, you know, Telstra did an internal promotion to CEO. I thought that was really fantastic. I know, look, you know, I know John Mullen pretty well, who chairs Telstra. And like, I thought that was one of the biggest wins. I mean, he's done some good things at Telstra, and that was one of the biggest wins of his tenure, a smooth internal promotion succession.
I think for, for bigger businesses, absolutely. But even for, I think for even scale-ups, I think bringing someone in, having them work for 3, 4, 5 years, Tim Cook style, is the way to do it. I think bringing in the hero externally very rarely works. You've got to have huge humility on both sides, and it's just hard.
And we'll be back in a few moments after a quick word from our sponsor. Our podcast sponsor, Ramon Advisory, is your trusted partner for all R&D tax incentives and EMDG grants. They work with companies to help them claim up to 43.5% of all genuine R&D expenses, and they make the process super easy. With 12 years' experience, CoMD Lior Steen is ready to help you, just like he helps Adir with all his startups. For more information and to use their free calculators, visit the website at rimon.com.au. That's RIMON.com.
Now it's back to the contrarians.
Our second story, and this one caught our eye, is the very successful burger chain Grilled, which last week was revealed to have received $30 million in taxpayer funding for its aptly named Hamburger University. According to the AFR, total cash paid to Grilled under the coalition's flagship $5.8 billion trainee and apprenticeship wage subsidy leapt to $28.3 million by July this year. At the same time, the dropout rate for the compulsory training program went from 47 to 60%. That means more than one in every two people didn't finish the course. The funding allowed Grill to report a pre-tax profit last year of $15.8 million, which was a great turnaround from the $2.6 million COVID-impacted loss the prior year. New South Wales Labor Senator Tony Sheldon slammed former Coalition Skills Minister Michaelia Cash for setting up a bottomless trough for rent seekers, saying that Hamburg University saw Grilled handed $30 million for a so-called training program with a 60% dropout rate. So that's some hard-hitting words. Adir, what were your views on Hamburger U?
Well, I want to say firstly that Hamburger University is actually a real thing. You know, that's like it's a McDonald's thing.
Illinois, exactly.
It's in Illinois. It's got like... there's one in Sydney. Yeah, they can't call it university because you have to be accredited. They have it on the outside. But there's one in like it's in Beenley or something. Is that like I don't know where?
To be honest, it's probably while you look that up, it's probably no less noble than half the stuff that universities teach these days. So I almost rather send my kid to Hamburger U than some of the other more prestigious universities out there.
So actually, you know, there's a branch of Hamburger University in Thornley in Sydney, but they can't call it Hamburger University because it's not a university. So it's got some other, it's like the Charlie Bell School of Management or something like that.
I think Charlie Bell was the CEO of McDonald's who tragically had a heart attack. I think he was an excellent CEO.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, you're right.
Very young.
So you know what they're I just want to say, because Hamburger University, it's like one of the greatest things I've ever heard of. So
it's amazing.
Do you know what their logo is for the university?
Surely Ronald McDonald.
No, it's much better because it's a crest. But the crest is made up of like McDonald's fries coming out of a packet. So it's pretty fantastic. So I just want to say, you know, all props to McDonald's for their Hamburger University. This is obviously not Hamburger University. It's just a good buzzword that they came up with. But, you know, half of McDonald's management team went to Hamburger University, so I think it might actually be quite a sophisticated thing, to be honest.
Yeah,
and so the problem with this is I think that Labor senator or whoever it was correct in criticising the former government. Like, this is just opportunistic by Grilled. You've effectively got an entrepreneur where the government is saying, here's money that is legally available to you, and the entrepreneur is thinking, well, I pay a ton of tax in this country, so if there's ever money flowing the other way, I'm going to make sure I get my hands on it. You can agree or disagree with that. I'm probably more sympathetic to that than you are, but like that was JobKeeper.
I 100%
agree with
Simon Crowe, who's, I'm not sure he's the sole shareholder now.
I think he got rid of the other CEO. Guy, bought him out or something.
Yeah, there was a very big court case a couple of years ago. A guy called Jeff Bainbridge, who unfortunately got caught. He was the one who got caught with that extortion.
That's right.
I think smoking meth and there was an unfortunate lamp. But anyway,
right. It wasn't his story, house. But it was his house, and then it didn't go well.
He actually is in Middle Park, so not far from me. But I'm pretty sure Crowe bought out both Simon McNamara and Jeff Bainbridge, three very successful business people. And what a business Grilled has become. I think it's at least worth $400 or $500 million. It's an incredible business.
My kids love eating it. My son loves it.
Always busy.
Yeah.
It's incredible. So I agree with you. I think you can hardly blame Simon and the Grilled team for taking advantage. And you argue, if you're an executive who doesn't take advantage of you've actually failed in your fiduciary duties for your shareholders, because you've got a duty to maximize returns for the company. And if you don't, then you get criticized in another sense. I don't blame
Well, this was the JobKeeper argument about should they or shouldn't they give back the money. And the thing is, it was just dished out with no strings attached, broadly speaking, let's call it. I would have said, if you take the JobKeeper money and you declare a dividend at any time 2 years after taking the money, you got to return the money. So at least, you know, you don't have the money going directly from the taxpayer into the pocket of the shareholder. But I'll tell you some things about this.
Can I just talk about the JobKeeper point?
I know you get a bit worked up about JobKeeper, so I was just poking the bear a bit.
We could do a whole episode on the disgrace that was JobKeeper, but the difference between JobKeeper and this. This was a genuine program that was used correctly, and you can argue it was a stupid program. And I think we all agree it was, but there's not Grill didn't do anything wrong here versus JobKeeper, where there were so many stupid things about JobKeeper, almost the dumbest, well, the two dumbest things. One, there was no clawback, but two, it allowed you to guess what your revenue would be. So everybody said, oh, my revenue's dropped significantly. So all these businesses that are doing really well said, oh, my revenue's dropped, and there was no clawback. So it was just the dumbest, almost criminally inept Scott Morrison and Josh Frydenberg in how they just blew $300 billion of taxpayer dollars because they were so keen to lock down and just had no clue on how to manage anything economic.
Well, I like Josh. I think it was well-intentioned, but under pressure and some mistakes. And I don't have anything good to say about Scott Morrison. I don't know him, so I can't say anything either way.
I'm not friends with Josh. I went to uni in school with his wife, but I don't know Josh. But that was just a disgrace.
Let me tell you these things about this program and why people got worked up about Grilled. So it's effectively the taxpayer funding, I wouldn't call it an apprenticeship, I'd call it like a quasi-apprenticeship that results in a certificate. And so it's not just free money. Notionally, the people that study at this, you know, this Hamburger University, it's not Hamburger University, they get like a certificate 3 in retail or something like that. And that's part of this program. And so that's not the issue. The issue is that it was so ridiculously popular for something being subsidized that it's not clear that the Australian taxpayer is actually going to benefit from. And so what you'd be happy about is the main uptake of this program that that they were dishing out money was like electricians. So you can live with that. That's good. Electricians do it. And carpenters and some other things. But the number 3 in terms of the quantity of people taking it up was hospitality. And number 4 was retail. And I took a look at what this actually offered, because Open Universities offers this course. So this gives you, you know, it's called a Certificate 3 in Hospitality. And so let me tell you, you can go and study this Certificate 3 at places like Victoria University or Open University. And what it teaches you, I'm not saying this disparagingly, I'm just giving you an idea of what it teaches you. This is the bullet points on Victoria University's website. Teamwork, food and beverage service, workplace health and safety, customer service, alcohol and bar operation, espresso coffee preparation, food and beverage matching. So this is an idea of what it's doing. And so that's fine. And so you can go to Open University and get this, and it will cost you, you can do it over 18 months, there's a couple of hours a week or whatever it is, and it will cost you $3,000. And the problem is, this is the way that the Australian government was offering it. They would pay up to half of somebody's salary to the value of $7,000 a quarter. So that's $28,000 a year.
How long does the course take? So and what's the total?
You can do it, as I said, over 12 months or 18 months. I don't know how long they were paying it for to someone like a Grilled, but it's likely that this is what was going on, that Grilled took a look at this and said, legitimately, we can say that these people are going and getting this training. By the way, it was compulsory to do this course, even if you were concurrently studying another course at university or something. At least that was what was reported. And what it effectively did is gave them very large salary offsets for their employees. Yep. A ton of people dropped out. And the government, which was the enabler of all of this, was probably severely overpaying for a course that private enterprise was offering more cheaply and that we didn't need in this country anyway. There was no argument for taxpayers funding it. And so I would say this is a case where really no action should be taken against Grilled or anybody who's taking advantage. But 99 Bikes was another big recipient of the retail version
Screw
of this.
Screw and screws.
Yeah, that was another. And so I think this just highlights clueless governments going and dishing out taxpayer money because it's not their own money. And whenever someone talks to me about increasing taxes, I say, that's fine. But first, go find all this stuff and get rid of all of this stuff. And then talk to me about increasing taxes, because that's my issue with this
whole
corporate
world. The corporate welfare, I mean, it's not just corporate. Even like NDIS. Problem with the NDIS is there's a lot of people who really should be getting the NDIS, but there's a lot of people who probably shouldn't. So, and that's just such a, when you're giving, I don't know, $70 billion a year or whatever it is, or it could even be more now, you're going to have a big chunk of that's wasteful, because just the law of averages sets that probably $20 billion of that. So there's so much wasted government. I'd love to get some people who actually have a clue how to run government in government. Problem is the nature of government is that you don't get that. So you get cronyists who just get bought.
Of course.
We talk about it in terms of the Qantas Chairman's Lounge. That's just one really obvious example, but this happens countless times.
I will say, though, the last thing, because I know that you're somewhat close with the people behind this business, but I will say this. When there's a list of how many trainees different people, different companies took up under this program, number two was Reece, you know, the bathroom and plumbing supplies. And they were 1,083, this is according to the Financial Review. And number one was Grilled with 2,728. So there was this enormous gap between number one and two, and predominantly below those two, it was mostly things like mining services, construction, employment services. Like, this was anomalous in the volume and also the nature of the business. And again, I'm not saying that as a criticism of Grilled, and this is not a legal disclaimer, I just don't think they should be criticised. Like, it was totally acceptable for them to do this. This is, I think it was the last government, so I think this government's actually shut down this program.
Yeah, I'm sure I did. And I think it's hard to think of a worse government. Regardless of, I think most Liberal voters probably think the same, that Morrison government's probably the worst government Australia's ever had. I can't think of a worse one in my lifetime. Obviously, I haven't really 43 years old, but I can't think of any other government in my life.
I think it was. I think there's a, I agree with you. There's a pretty universal view about that. And like, you know, I said, I'm not on the left. Like, that's not, like, I think it was pretty terrible. I also think that, you know, it is infuriating, this immense wastage that nobody could care less about. Like, this program would have gone completely under the radar if some journo didn't decide that Hamburger University was going to, like, get clicks. And I'm being a bit disparaging.
That's a great
but,
name.
Yeah, but you know, like, this is the value of journalism. I mean, when I talk to journalists, they're so undervalued journalists, but actually this is the value of journalism. Like, they undercover this stuff.
Absolutely.
We know that the government's, there will be people trying to suppress this. By the way, even Grilled and McDonald's have tried to suppress some data in the past about this under freedom of information. They're not that happy with people knowing about it. But, you know, imagine how much government waste is sliding under the radar like this would have if not for these stories.
100% agree. Congratulations to Journo. I'm not sure who it was who discovered it. Yeah. And I'm not close with Simon at all at Grilled. I think I met him once. But incredible business. I think we sort of say both Grant and Reece, who was number two or number three, even better. I think Reece is like a $10 billion.
Family business, basically. That's been
family, and still run by the family, I think 80 years on. What a two incredible businesses and run very well by some very exceptional founders and subsequent founders. And we'll be back in a few moments after a quick word from our sponsors. Bad and Financial are experts in financial planning and are proud sponsors of The Contrarians. They work with high-income professionals and successful business owners to build a comprehensive wealth management plan. They also specialize in family succession planning. Exclusively for our listeners, the team at Bad and Financial are offering a free two-hour consultation to assess your personal needs and advise on how they can help build your wealth. To take up this great offer,
please call 02-4937-0270 or visit badhamfinancial.com.au. Now, back to the pod.
Let's move on to our big story for the week, which is the gig economy. And there was news last week that US-based business Instacart, the original gangster of supermarket delivery, is planning an IPO in what will be the mother of all down rounds. Instacart was last valued at US $39 billion when it raised money 2 years ago. In an unusual move, Cornerstone investors have agreed to buy up to $400 million worth of proceeds in this offering, which is at only US, well, there's a bit of a range, but about US $9 billion. And those Cornerstone investors would account for about two-thirds of the proceeds. Operationally, Instacart isn't actually doing too badly. In the first half of this year, it generated $242 million in profit compared to a $74 million loss for the same period a year ago. It also grew at 31%, which is pretty impressive coming off pandemic highs. So, Dion, you're very interested in the gig economy and the impact of that. How do you view the Instacart down round and then the gig economy in general? Are you bullish on it? Are you a pessimist on the gig economy?
The gig economy to me is very complicated. Obviously, it went through this period, as everything sexy does. Any name you could attach the word gig economy to any business would have a huge valuation and it would fly. And, you know, I'm old enough to have seen a couple of rounds of this already. Like before the dot-com crash in 2000, you know, there were, I think there was one called van.com or something like that. And
Webvan.
You're right, it was Webvan. And so I've seen, like, there's been a couple of like instances of this happening. That wasn't necessarily gig economy because it wasn't the decentralized workforce model that Postmates and those types kind of pioneered. Yeah. I think this down round is sensible because the previous valuations were insanity. And ultimately, at some point in time, investors need to see money. And if they're walking around saying, we're not going to take anything lower than a $39 billion valuation, and someone says, how about a $9 billion valuation? And some of them probably put in at like a $300 million valuation, they're better off taking some money. So I think, you know, that's sensible. For me, the gig economy is a pretty complicated issue just because of its reliance on uncontracted workers and the move globally in Western democracies, maybe outside the US, to start thinking about how those people should be treated as independent contractors, whether they should have various protections. Obviously, in Australia, that's becoming quite a significant issue. My personal view is there should not be a mechanism for employing people in any way that pays them significantly less than what we've agreed is the minimum pay that people should have. I know that sounds like a mere socialist talking, but like I do, I feel very strongly about that. And then the flip side argument, which is, but they've agreed to it. I mean, like if I'm poor and I can't eat and I agree to give up one of my kidneys to get paid, nobody makes the same argument. So I think agreeing to something out of necessity, and I know there's a lot of jobs floating around in the economy, maybe it's not necessity, but just agreeing to something where there's a significant imbalance in the relationship between the two parties. I don't think that's good enough. I think, to me, the gig economy still needs to be sorted out from an employee point of view.
I agree. I don't want to see people getting paid $3 an hour to provide valued work. But how do you differentiate? Let's look at the classic gig economy business, Uber versus taxis. I'm not sure Uber drivers get paid any less than a taxi. They may even get paid more than a taxi driver if they're a good Uber driver, or less if they're bad, or not as skilled. No one seems to say the same thing about taxi drivers.
If an Uber driver is getting paid the same as a taxi driver, or what, even if they were getting paid less, I know you're saying more, but even if it was less, but it was something that society deemed to be an acceptable level of pay, I would have no issue with that whatsoever. I like the gig economy. I think there are lots and lots of benefits to decentralizing people's ability to work at times and in places that are convenient for them. I'm generally a huge supporter of that. But I think the easiest way to assess it is to say, you know, what's the median amount of money that people are being paid per amount of time or whatever it is, and what does the curve look like, you know, when you plot it, and making sure that it doesn't start heading towards an unacceptably low income. And as long as that's not the case, I'm totally relaxed about it. I think my general view is that the Labor government is going to go too far in enforcing various protections on gig workers, and it will take away some of their flexibility. On the flip side, I think that workers constantly under pressure in the gig economy to make deliveries within a certain amount of time, or they'll be fired or be docked pay or whatever it is. Like, I don't think you want people necessarily to live under that type of pressure in their work life either. So that's what I was saying to you. I think this balance still needs to be worked out.
I think just on that, and you mentioned that the Labor government, there's actually a new law proposed by the federal government a few weeks ago, in which gig workers in Australia, including rideshare drivers, food delivery riders, will soon benefit from minimum pay and protection against unfair deactivation. And the Fair Work Commission will also have power to set minimum standards for employee-like workers. I'm really torn on this stuff. I certainly don't like seeing people exploited. On the flip side, I also question, is the economic model of these businesses, short of them getting monopolistic powers, but as it stands, there aren't really any monopolies because there's pretty good competition.
And they mostly lose spaces. Money as well at the moment.
But generally, like, I think Uber Eats in Australia is quite profitable. Yeah. You know Jody better than me. I think that's quite profitable, certainly in certain cities.
We got to get Jody on the show. We're talking about Jody Oster. She's an ultra big shot. I mean, she was a big shot running Uber Eats, but she reports directly to the CEO, runs the whole of strategy. It's an unbelievable Australian. It's an unbelievable. She, I mean, we're giving her big props. I spoke to her like 2 weeks ago, but like she's an unbelievable Australian success story for a huge global technology business. Anyway, we'll.
I think you look at you and Jody, the two former doctors. There's a few others in the business world, probably the two best. So if you go back to. The gig economy businesses. The problem is, everybody has a crack at Uber Eats and DoorDash for the 30% they take from merchants, and they do take less for the bigger merchants, but I think often take 30%. But the problem is, you've got to give the rider 20%, and even that isn't enough to pay the rider enough wage often. So I'm not sure the economic activity of picking up food from a restaurant and delivering it 3 or 4 Ks makes sense.
Oh, I agree with you. I mean, and it's because the good news was for the last decade, there was a Robin Hood model where you took money from VCs and gave it to regular people in the form of subsidized deliveries. But if they actually have to make money, I agree with you. And so my view on it is this. We could all make much more money if we just didn't pay our staff. Like, it would be much more profitable. But obviously, that is idiotic. And so my view of that, that's my universal view about all businesses. If you can't make money by paying people fairly and giving them fair protections, then you shouldn't be running that business. That business should not exist. And I agree with you. The idea that somehow miraculously everything that you want to buy will appear on your doorstep for almost no incremental cost 1 hour later, that's insanity as a concept. And like, maybe when we've got drone networks, it might be a different story. But for as long as you have to pay human beings, I just think you cannot pay people in a way that makes them live a terrible life. And so, you know, I don't want you to be Karl Marx here and, you know, advocate for the Labor government, because there's lots of things about this government I do not like at all. I'm pretty supportive of what they're doing, to be honest.
Well, look at Milk Run, which the now defunct, bought by Woolworths for $10 million or whatever, raised 75, I think. And they were one of the only ones that effectively treated their delivery drivers like actual employees, full-time salaried employees. And they went under pretty quickly. It's Danny Milham, the former founder of Koala. Right. So experienced founder, two-time founder, and raised a heap of capital from some, I would have thought, pretty smart investors.
I lost money in that
business.
They
couldn't have come close to making
Not directly, but through VC funds. I agree.
As a customer, that was the greatest customer.
That's what everyone said.
It was insane. You would order, like, basically say, I could order something in 30 minutes. Like, it actually did come in 30. It was... I think one time it even came quicker. It was, I don't know how you could physically pick, pack, deliver the stuff. It came in like 15 minutes once. It was just mind-boggling. Was it even 10 minutes at one point? I think they actually had a 10-minute
And the staff liked working for them. And this is the problem. So you make a small amount of money on groceries, not much. We talked about that. Like, there's a gross margin of circa 30% that you're making on groceries, probably less for them. That's a supermarket margin. And then there's this...
Well, I think they marked up a little bit, so I think they probably would have had...
Let's say 35%, but then you've got to deliver this, and nobody is paying for the true cost of delivery. And so the people that are paying... And then, not even that. Like, I suspect they were losing money on the delivery itself, which means all of their fixed costs, like they're starting below zero before they have their fixed costs. And ultimately, the VCs in this market of, you know, constrained capital are just not prepared to keep funding it. And so I don't know if there'll ever be the right model for this. I am certain when there are drones, presuming we can figure out a way to get them to work effectively in a network, I don't mean technically, but like it's pretty noisy. And like there's some constraints we're going to have to overcome. But let's say we get there in one form or another, then I am certain that this instant delivery stuff is going to be a huge success, but I'm not sure about whether human beings are going to be economically viable to cheaply deliver products to people in crazy amounts of time. I think the jury's out.
No, I think the drone thing's right. It's a bit like the dream of self-driving cars and Uber Ride, which we're still waiting for.
But that's what happens with tech, right? Like tech feels like it moves so quickly, and then you're shocked at how fast it's come. And then it gets to 85% and then it stalls because the last 15% is like really, really hard. And that is, to me,
that's the general story
of tech innovation. Like you're shocked at how quickly it starts moving, but mostly it does get stuck at about 85% and some of it never gets to 100 and some of it just takes a long time to get to 100.
Yeah. It's like when you look back to the future too, and they had all those, effectively those predictions and a lot of them came true, but the flying car one clearly, we're nowhere close to it, but a lot of the other predictions
we might get to flying cars hoverboards. If they're like drone.
I think we'll get there.
Drone like
they have them now. The lifting up one. What are the ones that lift up? What are they called? Self lifting or whatever.
VTOL, vertical takeoff and landing.
VTOL. Yeah. The Uber helicopter thing. Uber Eats, ironically, is got to profitability on the base of charging all these extra fees. So yeah, Uber Eats charge you delivery
fee,
service fee. They charge it. They charge what I call a blackmail / ransom fee. They basically
I don't think that's that's not the title they use on the app, right?
They don't call it that. But I used to be a massive Uber Eats advocate, by the way. I wrote articles about it probably 6-7 years ago, how much I loved it. But now I hate it. The notion that you have to pay a fee to not be. So basically, if you don't pay a fee, you won't get your food delivered first. So basically, holding your food hostage, they can deliver it to some other guy. So your food comes. So you basically pay an extra $5 to not get cold food. Sure, that's. It's like me saying, if you don't pay me $100 extra for a holiday, I'm going to give you a room.
But I don't think it's extreme. Like I've tried both of them, like Priority, which I think is $4, and regular.
Yeah.
And like it's hit and miss in my experience. Like when I do, it's not a good advertisement for Uber, but I don't do the Priority one anymore because I didn't find that it made such a big difference between the two of them. And so, but I agree with you, there's a lot of fees. And like, I just got this notification which said, what's Uber's subscription thing they're sucking out of me? You know, I told you Uber One, I subscribe to everything. This was the email lauding the value of Uber One, which was kind of an email that went along the lines of, congratulations, you've made back in savings the cost of your Uber One. And I thought, is that a sales pitch? Like I have to pay upfront for this thing and like, woohoo, you didn't lose money on it. And like, it's a crazy pitch. By the way, my issue with Uber, the ride company now, because I agree, I used to love it, is that they keep sending me Teslas and I do not find Teslas comfortable to sit in.
I love Teslas.
The back seat of a Tesla?
I only drive it.
All right, sit in the back seat of a Tesla and –
my kids never complain.
All right, but kids can like, they're resilient, you know, resilient. So maybe not. Like, you claim that you're Gen Y, so who, I don't know if your kids are. Gen X kids, my kids, you know, we're like the helicopter parents. No, we were resilient. We were latch kids, right? Yeah. We came in the house by ourselves and then over-protected our own kids and now they can't even do it with the shoelaces. Like,
I think it's anyone under the age of – our parents really – I reckon my parents leave me at home. I reckon I was 10 or 11. To ask someone who – I always ask this question. I got kids who are 6 and 8, so we're not at that stage yet, sadly. But I ask parents who got kids who are 12, 13, 14. I said, do you leave your kids at home? Assuming – I want them to say yes, so I can then leave my kids at home when they turn 11 or whatever. So, no. And I said, how can you not? Like, surely at 13 you
can leave the majority. It's not the majority. I'm not sure. So my kids now are almost 17 and 14. And obviously I leave them at home by themselves now. But like – I'm not sure when they were like, what would it have been? Like 14 and 11.
Say 9 so I can start leaving my kids at home.
You know,
year.
There's actually no, this is my understanding. So if we can be corrected by the, you know, state police, but there's actually, I don't think, a legal re- age where you are or are not allowed to leave your kids at home by themselves. I mean, obviously, if you leave them home when they're one, it's not going to be good news.
It becomes abuse, I think.
But there's no cutoff. It doesn't say, like, this is the age where you need to leave. You can start leaving your kids at home.
No, I don't think there is.
But I'll tell you something that I do that there is no chance that you do. I give this a 0% chance, okay? So I have always booked the Uber Premier or Premium or whatever it's nowadays called. Am I right? You don't do that. Oh, I figured that was
the This Uber Black or the
original
Uber
Black, right. Which was the original Uber. And so I used to book that. In the US, I used to get a Cadillac Escalade. That was the common. You know what that is? I mean, that is a beautiful car. Massive. In Australia, I used to get really nice cars. Progressively, that has just diminished. And that's fine. Like, I'm not, the King of England that I need to be driven around. Whatever. But I just thought it's marginally more expensive and it's going to be more, I cared about being a nicer driver. Like, the driver was going to be more professional. But the quality of that service, in my view, has degraded to the point where, like, I now book Uber Comfort. Have you ever used that, Uber Comfort? It's like a few dollars more, not much. And it's a nicer car, basically.
Yeah.
And so...
No, I've only ever booked the normal Uber and then the extra large Uber, which is usually pretty good. I got a great taxi story. I went on a taxi, and I always like to try and tip taxi drivers.
Do
if
you?
I can. They work super hard. They're not getting paid as much as I can. I'd love to be really rich now and tip taxi drivers $100. That'd be my dream to one day.
You've got very achievable dreams. I just want to point that out. That is a recipe for happiness in life, by the way, not to get too philosophical.
People always talk about charity as the person giving charity is that such a great guy or girl. It's the ultimate selfish act. You're taking money from someone and you're getting credit.
I totally agree with you. We can go and have the altruism debate and we'll be on the same side of it. It's just self-interest, right?
No, I mean, I was speaking to a taxi driver and I got in the car and he was really happy and he said, I've got like five tips today. And I said, oh, that's great. And he goes, I reckon what happened is he got in the cab, the first guy gave him a tip, and then he gave the next guy really good service because the first guy, he gave him a tip, and the next guy, he gave good service. So I think it was a chain of, there was a direct causation correlation between good service and the ultimate tip. And I would give him a tip, but he was such a great guy, so happy, so willing to, this is a great pay it forward. You give a taxi driver a tip, they're more likely to treat the next person well. Classic free rider effect. So the next person gets the benefit of your tip.
Well, I have a more philosophical view of that. Now that you've raised it, which is that the curve of emotions is viral. It's an exponential curve. And so that's how I think about life. This is a very life-type comment. But so if you're nice to the taxi driver, then he or she is not only going to be nice to the next passenger, they might be nice to the next 20 people they encounter in life. And every one of those people is now going to get that positive emotion and they're going to take it through their life. And that is why I think it is so so powerful, even as one person, the way you treat a human being is so powerful because that ripples through all of the subsequent contacts they have over the next period of time. And so, look, I completely agree with you about that. And by the way, I don't even care about the freeloader. Like if I got someone, I once gave money to a homeless person. I mean, not once, but like there was on an occasion I gave money to a homeless person. I never have cash. That's a problem, right? But I gave money to a homeless person.
And then the homeless guy, the homeless community need to get
I know. How many times I've been pitched that business idea, by the way? Like a lot. Yeah. And so I gave money and then I was with someone and it was not a small amount of money, not huge, right? And they said to me, but don't you think that person is just going to use that money for alcohol or cigarettes or whatever it is? And do you know what my answer to that question was? I said to them, that's got nothing to do with me. Like I can control my bit of this relationship, which is trying to make that person feel like they're not alone and somebody cares about them. That's how I feel about giving money to someone who's on the street. It's like the money obviously is important to them because they don't have money, but mostly they get walked past. They spend their whole life like getting walked past. Once I do my bit of it, the rest is up to them and that's their choice. And that's how I've always felt about this kind of thing.
On that note, I think
No, you can't sign off. There's something that you said we would mention every week. How have you forgotten this?
I did. I said.
I know why you're not mentioning it. Because Richard Goyder is still in a job. That's why.
Oh, is this the? Sorry, this is the.
You've forgotten. How convenient you've forgotten.
I'm very comfortable in the bed. We never actually set the terms of the bed. I think it should be some sort of lunch or some sort.
Oh, I've got the greatest thing for you.
Well, why don't you get your mate Chris Lucas to give us a lunch? So if when I win
not
the bed, you don't have
not
to pay
give
anything.
Us a lunch. I'm going to say we've got to go for lunch, and the cost per head is a minimum of $200 per person. How's that? That's a lot of pressure on you.
That is. I'm pretty confident, mate. I saw Rita Bahani wrote a story, The Goiter's Got to Go.
I saw that.
Almost every day, someone is writing. Rita's great. She's a great, great friend of Lux.
Is that what? So I don't know her, but you are not a person that I would have picked to be out on her particular part of the political spectrum, which is very far to the right.
We don't agree on a lot of stuff, but we very certainly agreed on during COVID on everything. Yeah. She was aligned with us in COVID. But I actually find I disagree with a lot of people on certain issues, but can agree with other stuff. But I think she's lovely, generally. I'm not sure
I think you'll be cancelled for saying that you have a diversity of opinions and don't take one particular side. I'm not sure that's acceptable anymore, by the way.
Well, I think we both do. I think we're both ultimate centrist, so get hated by everyone, which I'm putting rightly or wrongly.
So Richard Goiter is still in his Qantas job. I think if he survives September, he's home free for the next 6 months because there's no next big Qantas thing coming. I mean, this chairman's lounge at the moment is toxic, right? There's going to be a whole lot of people over the course of the next 1 to 2 months that are in positions where they in some way are going to be arbitrating on Qantas. Politicians, judges, regulators, they're all going to have to give up their Qantas chairman's lounge membership. I think that's where the world is going at the moment.
Yeah, the judges' habit is almost the biggest disgrace of them all because judges sit in the High Court heard of Qantas here. They ruled against Qantas, so good on the High Court for not being biased. But there's certainly an apprehension of bias, which is the legal test. It's not whether you are or not biased actually irrelevant. It's whether
that's a good point.
Think you're biased, which is the legal test. When you've got News Corp, Fairfax, the ABC, the Guardian, all in agreement on something, it's pretty rare that the person they're in agreement on who needs to go can stay. Look at the fact that he was a terrible CEO, he's been a terrible chairman.
But he survived a very bad High Court outcome for Qantas, which was effectively, I mean, it's a bad outcome because it's saying under your chairmanship, they broke the law. The unions are going to come and sue them.
$200 million.
The unions are going to come and sue them for the union fees that they lost. You know, that's what I read. So, but I think he's still alive after that. This is a good bet. I like this bet. By the way, you're much more confident than I am. I'm not 100% confident.
I'm very confident. This is about as confident as I've ever been on a bet. Hopefully, this doesn't.
I'm 25% confident. I can't lose because if you're right, I say, three-quarters I agreed with you. I have to pay for the lunch. And if I win, I'm like I'm a futurist if I win.
And we'll wrap up the episode there. Look forward to seeing you all next week. As always, a big thanks to our incredible sponsors, Bench Media, Remont Advisory, and Bowden Financial for making the show happen. Thank you for listening to The Contrarians with Adam and Adir. If you want to submit a question for the show, please send a voice recording to AdamJSchwab at Instagram. Today's show was produced by Killen Brown. Make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. And don't forget to give us a rating and tell your friends. We'll be back next week for our weekly analysis of all things growth and tech.